Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and
absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley to run the rule over the past week in the World Game. First edition news with Willem van Denderen shortly, and as always, during the show, we'll be joined by our former ITN journo turned pundit, Derek Dyson. First topic of discussion this week with the APL managing director, Danny Townsend, is the rebranding of the A and W leagues, with the men's and women's competition now to sit under the A-Leagues umbrella. That's A-Leagues, plural, abandoning the use of W-League as a standalone title. Unfortunately, a little of the gloss was lost with the embarrassing similarity between the new logo and that of an Adelaide building company, but we don't want to lose the significance of the bigger story in what will eventually be remembered as an administrative bungle. So looking forward to a chat with Danny about what it all means. We'll talk to Willem about the Socceroos and Matildas' latest news. Then earlier this week, many of our listeners will have seen the Four Corners story, a league of their own, which ahead of the broadcast had many in the game on the edge of their seats, wondering what the expose would reveal. In the end, it was a veritable story of the emperor with no clothes, as the national broadcaster reheated stories which go back as far as the founding of the A-League to the frustration of many in the game. One of those was our friend Simon Hill from Ten and Paramount Plus, who'll join us to have a yarn about the motivation of the story and ask the question, did the ABC really think this was a scoop? Back to the football after that with The Athletic's Andy Naylor, the man on the Brighton and Hove Albion beat, to give us his thoughts on the incredible rebound of the Seagulls from relegation battle last season to the brink of top of the table. And of course, we'll wrap it up with our extended stoppage time as Derek goes through some of the other big stories of the week. So, Edge, what do you put your finger on the pulse? There was plenty to come out of this past week, as there always is.
I've got to say that I do align with your comments about Four Corners. That grabbed my attention early in the week on Monday evening, but it was a bit of a yawn, and I'm looking forward to talking with Simon Hill about that and just what it was all about. I'm still struggling to find the reasons why. Maybe it's an indication of Four Corners, and they are not the show they once were, Rob. But without any further delay, let's check in with Willem van Denderen, who has all the latest headline news. Hello, Willem.
Hello, Michael. I certainly do. G'day, Rob. Hope you're going well. All the listeners out there. The APL has unified Australia's domestic leagues under one moniker, with the A-League and W-League rebranded to A-League Men and A-League Women. The Y-League will also be known as A-League Youth, as the APL seek to bring the women's game to equal standing in public consciousness. The A-Leagues, as they will be known, also released a new logo, which you mentioned, Rob, and they may well have breached trademark legalities, as it is identical. And we mean identical, a dead ringer to that of company Adelaide Building Consulting. Michael, I want to throw to you first. I think everyone in the Australian football public has applauded the social and the ethical direction that's being targeted here by the APL, but I don't think anyone thought the term the W-League was broken in any way. I think it was, in fact, the opposite, much loved and has its own culture and history, and I think it'll be retained colloquially. I'm not sure that anyone will sort of get their head around the old tongue twister that's now in place.
Well, fans of the W League used to call it the Dub. I just wonder whether that nickname will stick. I hope it does. But I actually quite like what they've done, A-League in and A-League Women and A-League Youth. I think it's a good development. I think it will help consolidate a lot of their media assets and exposure and integrate the women's side of the game a little bit more. I think they've done it for one reason, not only the social impact of what you were alluding to, Willem, but it makes commercial sense too. Corporations are really looking to market through the women's game, and we've seen that with the recent CommBank announcement with the Matildas. I think it's a smart move by the APL. They should be applauded for it, and we'll talk to Danny Townsend shortly and learn more about the strategy and how they've gone about it.
The Matildas will return home in October for two friendlies against Brazil, with the federal and New South Wales governments waiving mandatory 14-day quarantine periods. The matches will be played in Parramatta on October 23 and 26, with a similar plan still in the works to welcome the US women's team in November. The Socceroos' home clash against Oman will again be played in Doha on October the 7th, but hopes are now up for a return in November. And Robert, is a hearty congratulations and well done in order to Football Australia. They've been long and drawn out and sort of unflinching negotiations for a lot of it, but it's going to be a magnificent occasion, firstly, when the Matildas return home, and then hopefully the Socceroos off the back of that.
Yeah, it's going to be massive news for football to take centre stage as, if not the first, then certainly one of the earliest sporting organisations to have crowds in stadiums, certainly international crowds. Look, the pressure's going to be on Tony Gustafsson. We talked about it last week. The Matildas haven't been setting the world on fire. Admittedly, they got a fourth spot at the Olympics, though, you know, if we do reflect on it, we had expected a lot more. The fact that we were satisfied with fourth was really off the back of the underwhelming friendly lead-in. So the subsequent match is one that is the most memorable. And so he really needs to get them in some kind of form so that when they return home that that we see the kind of Matilda action and form that that we're used to, and don't disappoint the big crowds that are inevitably going to be there.
Overseas now, just a week after the passing of Jimmy Greaves, England have lost another member of their 1966 World Cup squad, with Roger Hunt passing away aged 83. Hunt remains second for the most goals in Liverpool history with 285 from 492 matches played between 1958 and 1969. Hunt scored 41 goals to help Bill Shankly's side out of the second division in 62 before winning the first division in 64 and 66 and the FA Cup in between. Sir Roger, as he was affectionately known, also had a fruitful three seasons with Bolton Wanderers and scored 18 goals in 34 for England. He played every game of the 1966 World Cup. And Rob, back to you as our Liverpool man. It's always nice, never nice when they pass away, but at 83 you'd think Roger hopefully lived a full life, and it is nice for people of my generation. I think it'd be fair to say that he was maybe one of the lesser known names of the 1966 World Cup squad, but when you look through the figures and the records, it's not hard to see why this team was actually good enough to go on and win the World Cup.
Yeah, exactly. When you have a player of the stature of Roger Hunt, as you say, not one of the big names in that 1966 squad, it does tell you the quality of the man himself. And even Jurgen Klopp this past week said that there was no player more important to Bill Shankly's squad than Roger Hunt. That's high praise indeed. So yeah, we'll talk a little more about Roger later on in the show, but you know, the tributes have been coming in thick and fast for not only a great footballer, but a great man as well.
Onto the pitch, Sheriff Tiraspol stole the show in the second match day of the Champions League with a last-ditch 2-1 win over Real Madrid at the Bernabeu. The Transnistrian side opened the scoring through Yasburik Yakshiboev before Karim Benzema levelled from the spot. Later, 89 minutes in, Luxembourg international Sebastian Till won it with a brilliant volley. Elsewhere, Juventus beat Chelsea 1-0 through Federico Chiesa. Barca's woes continued with a 3-0 loss to Benfica, and Manchester United pulled it out of the fire against Villarreal.
Fernandez, clever pass to Fred. Early cross, a knockdown from Ronaldo. Lingard's there, Ronaldo's there! Manchester United win it, and Cristiano Ronaldo in the last minute of stoppage time.
Copa America winners Argentina and European champions Italy will meet in an exhibition match next June as UEFA and CONMEBOL cozy up in opposition to FIFA's calendar overhaul plans. Naples is reportedly a contender to host what will be the first of three editions of the match. Their joint statement read, UEFA and CONMEBOL express a strong willingness to continue collaborating on other issues of mutual interest going forward. And Rob, it's not too hard to see what those other issues might just be. From a football sense, it seems fun. It'll be a good game. Everyone will enjoy it. But from a political broader standpoint, it's quite provocative. How much impact do you think this will have? I reckon it'll be just a small piece in what is an overall pretty big issue facing the game.
Look, it is. It's you know, a bit of an arm wrestle from the two powerhouse organisations that run the game on a world level and obviously a European level. And you know, naturally, CONMEBOL come into play as probably the third force in that discussion. But you know, they're all the national organisations, that is, you know, staking their claim to their position. And look, any match of that stature between the continental champions is going to get noticed. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I suppose you know, as an observer, you want to see a competitive match. So you know, I'll judge it by just how entertaining and competitive it is. I would have thought that there's no way in the world the Italians will go up against the Argentinians without both wanting to claim bragging rights. So yeah, we'll wait. wait and see.
And UEFA have filed for the removal of Judge Manuel Ruiz de Lara from their court proceedings against the European Super League. They've cited irregularities in his rulings. The judge had ruled UEFA must declare the punishments against the clubs null and void and not seek payment from the nine clubs who backed down. The Madrid Commercial Court has put a block on UEFA's action, and the European Court will now decide whether to uphold the judge's findings. So, Michael, this issue continuing to just be pushed further up the chain and further down the road, and funnily enough, as it all happens, the Champions League continues to deliver cracking football.
All right, Willem, well done. After the break, we are going to talk to Danny Townsend, the Managing Director of the Australian Professional Leagues and also CEO of Sydney FC, about the rebranding of the AW Leagues, the Y League as well, what it means, why they've done it. That's all next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Now, off the top of the show, we mentioned one of the big stories of the week, that the A and W leagues, as well as the Y League, are being rebranded under the umbrella of the A leagues. To talk to us about it is the Managing Director of the Australian Professional Leagues and CEO of Sydney FC, Danny Townsend. How are you, Danny?
Very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, really well, mate. Really well. Opinion in some areas is divided. You obviously got people who did like the W League moniker, but the story seems to have landed pretty well in terms of equality in sport. Other than that, can you just give us the helicopter explanation for the uninitiated as to why the decision was taken?
Yeah, no, look, and like all things with change, people often initially push back a little bit, but we've seen sort of overwhelming support the last sort of 24 hours since we launched. But yeah, to give you some insight into the sort of genesis of how we landed here was that when the APL took over from the FA in January, we really wanted to signal change and also unpack some of the things that we inherited that may or may not have been right for the game. And one of those was the brand architecture for the sport. And I think when we looked at the history of the A-League and where the name had come from, it stood for Australia, it stood for A-grade, A-quality, the highest level of football in Australia, which all makes perfect sense and understand why it was used. And then when we looked at the W-League, when it came in a couple of years later, and it was a real simple story, W is the first letter in woman. And we thought, well, you know, at the end of the day, if all those great things that sit in the narrative behind the A are applicable to men, why aren't they not applicable to the women? And that made it a pretty simple decision for us after a bunch of research. We talk about stakeholders, talking to players, coaches, grassroots community clubs, and it was overwhelmingly in support of the fact that A-League was such a powerful brand that it was important that it transferred across both the men's and the women's game, and that's what we did, and like I said, it's been well received.
Yeah, it has been largely, and we've seen some interesting stories from other sports around the country. Senior journos are calling on other organisations, the AFL and the NRL, to make similar decisions. Look, we want to talk about it a little more, but let's just touch briefly on the elephant in the room, the logo issue, the similarity with the Adelaide Building Company. Tell us how we're going to work through that, because our sense is that we don't want to lose the importance of the decision in what will eventually become fish and chip wrapper as maybe an administrative bungle down the track, but how are we going to work through that one?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe some journos might need to read up on their trademark law, but rest assured, we went through the processes that any organisation that's investing time and money in a rebrand to ensure that what we were launching was not something that was going to cause any legal challenges. It's funny, I had after I read the article in the Sydney Morning Herald today, which was clearly incorrect, I rang the CEO of that company, and we had a very good laugh, and we look forward to sharing a beer in Adelaide when I'm down there next. I think his biggest concern was that the similarity in logos would mean that we would force him to change his logo because we're a bigger enterprise than his, and that's not what we're about. I told him we have no issue with it. He's in the building sector, we're in the sports sector, we don't compete, and it was all a bit of a laugh, really.
Yeah, we somehow don't think people are going to be knocking on his door asking his opinion on both A-Leagues now, isn't it?
It was a great guy. It was quite funny. He said, it was the biggest number of hits I've had on my website since we started the company. I said, well, I should send you an invoice for promoting. But he was a good guy. We had a laugh, and yeah, it's all good.
Well, people are paying attention to it at least, mate. This is Box to Box. Yeah, we're talking to the Managing Director of the Australian Professional Leagues about the rebranding of the peak competitions in this country, Danny Townsend.
You must be a busy man combining both the MD of the new APL and obviously your Sydney FC CEO role. How are you going combining those roles? And you must be having some burning the candle at both ends.
Yeah, look, it's been challenging, but at the same time, it's rewarding in that it's not often you get to play a role in a complete, you know, reset and relaunch of a major sporting code in this country. And, you know, as a firm believer in the virtues of football and where it should sit in the hierarchy of Australian sport, you know, this was something that I couldn't not contribute to. And look, it's probably helped my marriage because I've seen less of my wife and my kids. So if you ask them, they love it. But no, look, in seriousness, it's been great. It's been hard work, but like with all great things, they don't come easy. And we're fortunate that when I went down this path with the APL board to sort of do the sort of dual roles, you know, I sort of impressed upon them the need for us to go out and hire high caliber executives to support me. And they approved me to do that. And I've really built a great team of executives at APL who are, as you're going to see over the last couple of months with the TV deal we've announced with Network 10 and now this brand alignment and a bunch of other announcements we're going to make in the coming weeks. You know, we've got some real momentum and we're excited about what it all means for the game.
Women's football is on the move and obviously this branding alignment allows probably some commercial upside too, but a lot of fans of the women's game are really eager for the A-League women's competition to go to a full home and away for two reasons, the integrity of competition, but probably more importantly, the development of our younger players. Can you tell us, in the list of priorities, and I know there's many, where does that one sit?
Yeah, right near the top. You know, our commitment to women's football is not just about changing a name. Like, that's actually the easy part. I said to someone earlier today, you know, don't judge us by the rebrand, judge us by the actions that we put forth on the back of that rebrand. And, you know, we've started that with the announcement of the APL Club Championship to elevate, you know, the points that the women's competition score and aggregate those with the men's competition to crown the A-League's best professional club in Australia. That's about elevating attention to the women's game. But importantly, the expansion of Wellington Phoenix into the league this season, adding Western United and Central Coast Mariners next season, that's all about more teams, more matches, more playing opportunities for aspiring young Australian and New Zealand female footballers. And then the next step is get to that that home and away at a minimum. You know, I see a day when the A-League's women and the A-League's men's seasons run concurrently for the entirety of the season. That's the goal. We will get there. There's some complexities that we need to manage, particularly as it relates to the orientation to the NPL. You know, unfortunately, the reality is that the majority of our A-League's women players are playing in the NBL, the NPL, as well as the A-League's women. And I think that's something that we need to fix as well, but that's going to take time. But yeah, look, our motivation's there to do it. It's part of our blueprint and we're committed to doing that. And we've made that pretty clear.
I want to ask you a question with your Sydney FC hat. On Monday night, Four Corners did a little show on foreign ownership in the A-League. I think it's remiss of me not to ask you about David Traktovenko. He's been a fabulous owner of Sydney FC. And I just wanted you to take an opportunity to educate our listeners right around Australia, just the significance of David, his support for the club, and also the importance of his investment to the stability and success of the club. I think fans would like to know a little bit about him. What can you tell us about David and the significance that he plays at your club?
Look, David is an unbelievable man, and I think the same could be said for Scott and Alina Barlow. You know, when I came to the club, when I've worked in football overseas and you understand the dynamics of the boardroom and the owner and the chairman, and, you know, I was told once by a friend of mine who was a CEO at Arsenal at the time, he said, if you've got a dysfunctional board, a lunatic chairman or a lunatic owner, one out of the three means it's a no-go club. Two out of the three, you know, leave the country sort of stuff. And I met the board, they were great. I met Scott, he was fantastic. The only person I hadn't met was the inverted commas Russian owner. And I got the opportunity to meet him during that process for the first time. and you couldn't have met a more humble, lovely human being in David. And since then, I've had the pleasure of working for the family and the club for that time. And it's I can't articulate it differently to say it's not about the money. The money, wealthy people can invest money in things. That's one thing. But it's the emotional energy, the time, the effort that family puts into the club that you don't see is what makes it really special. And you know, their whole lives revolve around making this club a club for all of Sydney to be proud of and all of Australian football to be proud of. And I think that's the stuff that they don't get enough recognition for. The money's one thing. Yes, it's been amazing. They put a lot in. But it's actually that hard work, that connection, that emotional sort of commitment they've provided to our club, which sort of goes unrecognised. So, yeah, look, they've been amazing. If you look at where the club was at when David and Scott took the majority share, it's gone from strength to strength, and that's no coincidence that, you know, their involvement in the club has been unbelievable.
So, Danny, just before we let you go, do you take offence when an organisation with the stature of the ABC puts together what's purported to be an expose and takes a drive-by at somebody? I mean, we've been doing this show for 300 episodes and, you know, we've done our best to have a crack at all the big stories. If we think something's legitimate, regardless of who it is, we'll have a crack at it. But in this instance, it just seemed like it was an attempt to cobble together a range of different elements that were all old news and put together something that ultimately it wasn't.
Yeah, look, to be honest, I was disappointed in them. I sort of hold the ABC in high regard, and that was clearly not to the standards you'd expect from that level of journalism. And look, to dignify it with a response was why we all went silent, because you let the court of public opinion make their case, and you only got to follow social media to see how reaction was to that piece of reporting. But look, at the end of the day, those that know and are close to the game know what all of those owners are doing to put us in a position where we are today to elevate this league and put football further up the hierarchy of Australian sport. And that's what we're committed to doing. It's, you know, we've been pushed to the periphery by the more traditional heritage Australian codes, and it's now our time to sort of stand up and be heard, and it's by no means those owners' commitments that have put us in a position to do that. So, yeah, I'm glad you're nonplussed, because that was our opinion. We knew it was coming, and, yeah, we weren't going to dignify that with any real response.
Yeah, and fair enough. It's well said, Danny. Hey, all the best with the rebranding, with the season to come. There's just so much to look forward to in football in Australia. You know, guys and girls across Australia who love football are not just exclusive to football. They love all sports in Australia, and agree with that comment that you made, that it's football's time to shine, and, you know, we've got so much to look forward to. So keep up the good work, mate, and we'll look forward to the upcoming seasons of both the women's and men's leagues, and see what this new branding and the new TV deal delivers for us all.
Yeah, and there's lots more to come. We've got a few big announcements in the next coming weeks, and also just want to say thank you to you guys for covering our game. You know, we need more of it, and you guys are doing a great job, so thank you for doing that.
Thank you, Danny. Much appreciated, mate. Danny Townsend, the Managing Director of the Australian Professional Leagues and CEO of Sydney FC.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
The Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. It's Soccer is Matilda Central time. But before we do, our very good friends at Chemist Warehouse have got an important message for you if you haven't heard it already. If you're running low on everyday vitamins or cosmetics but can't get to the shops, Chemist Warehouse has a solution. You can stock up on everything you need by simply shopping online at chemistwarehouse.com.au. Just spend $30 or more and Chemist Warehouse will deliver your order within 3 hours for free. That's right. Just spend $30 or more at Chemist Warehouse and they'll deliver your order within 3 hours for free. So get on, spoil yourself with your essential health and wellness needs with free delivery within 3 hours from Chemist Warehouse to your house. But you better hurry. This offer ends October 31st and excludes prescriptions and pharmacist-only medication. Selected stores only. Chemist Warehouse, fast delivery, powered by DoorDash. Willem,
Thank you, Rob. Socceroos and Matilda Central for the Green and Gold Army. Packages for the Qatar 2022 World Cup are not far away, so make sure you're on the mailing list to find out new information as soon as it comes to hand. Take the first step of a memorable journey today and sign up to the mailing list at ggotravel.com.au. Socceroos World Cup qualifiers are on next week, guys, and there looked to be a slight injury concern to Harry Suter. He limped off for Stoke at the end of a 2-0 win over Callum Elders Hull City. Fortunately for Harry and for Graham Arnold, who, of course, is his biggest admirer, he took the pitch on Wednesday morning as Stoke drew 1-0 with Preston. The man behind Suter in the Socceroos pecking order as it stands, Miloš Deganek, has once again been playing consistently in Serbia. Red Star Belgrade are 5 points off top spot after 9 and have a game in hand on first position. Down in League One, the tide might finally be turning for Bailey Wright and poor old Sunderland. Bailey opened the scoring against Cheltenham. That was their first of 5 goals and kept a clean sheet. So, Michael, the Black Cats sit top, 3 points clear of Wigan. In Scotland, Cameron Devlin made a memorable home debut for Hearts as they put 3 past Livingston and was widely acclaimed in the press to be the man of the match, so making an instant impact with the fans there. But issues continue to mount for Ange Postecoglou and Celtic, frustrated by Dundee with a 1-1 draw. And Matt Ryan made his debut for Real Sociedad in their 3-2 away win to Granada, but was benched for the next match. Sociedad, of course, in the Europa League with Ange Postecoglou and Celtic. To the Matildas, there were plenty of Aussies on the score sheet as the Women's Super League returned. Sam Kerr scored a brace and set up another as Chelsea made a statement against Manchester United, winning 6-1. Sam was also on the score sheet in the Cup against Birmingham. Other big winners in the league included West Ham, where Tamika Yallop scored the opener in their 4-0 win over Leicester. And Emily Gelnick scored her first goal for Aston Villa in their 1-0 win over Brighton. Terrible news, however, for Chloe Legazzo, who confirmed, we saw her hobbling up off against Ireland. She confirmed she has torn her ACL. FFA Cup wrap-up. Adelaide United and Adelaide Olympic both scored 3 goals away from home this week to progress to the last 16. United were taken to extra time by Perth's Floriat Athena last Sunday before running out 3-1 winners, while Olympic wore down ECU Joondalup and added 3 goals in the final 20 minutes. The compartmentalisation of the FFA Cup is set to continue into the last 16. So the 5 sides through to the Northeast Zone, as it's been called, can begin their matches late next month. So Lions FC will host Brisbane Roar, Adelaide Olympic will host Adelaide United, and Gold Coast Knights will play the winner of Adelaide City. And Adelaide City are themselves still waiting on the winner of Perth Glory and Melbourne Victory. So a very strange scenario occurring at the moment with the FFA Cup. And a bit of A-League news to finish. Stephen Taylor was named captain of Wellington just 4 days ago, but since then he's actually retired and called time on his career. He was both unwilling to spend another season on the road with Wellington and has also stated he was hurt the club wouldn't offer him a 2-year deal. They reportedly said they'd like to see how his body held up this season before an extension, which he saw as a knock on his professionalism. So he's wrapped it up and called time.
Box to box. For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings,
and Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal.
This is Box to Box. Earlier on in the show, we were talking to Danny Townsend, the managing director of the Australian Professional League, CEO of Sydney FC, about a number of different topics, one of which was, of course, the Four Corners story from earlier in the week. To flesh that out a little bit more is our friend from the Ten Network and Paramount Plus, Simon Hill. How are you, Simon?
Very good, guys. How are you?
Yeah, really well. And we were on Twitter as well about the time that you posted your observations on this so-called expose. Now, look, it's fair to say, Simon, in all the years we've known you and you've come on the show, you've never pulled a punch. You sometimes get into strife by being as honest as you are, mate. And if there was a legitimate story to tell, you're not the sort of guy, and we don't think we are either, to shovel it under the carpet and pretend it didn't exist. But the way that we all independently interpreted this story was that it was, I think I used the term earlier, reheating old soup. John Stensholt might have even taken a little offence. I noticed he picked up on your tweet that he'd written a book about this a while ago. So, you know, just give us your general views of what it was and why we needed to see that story, if at all.
Well, look, to be honest, I mean, I don't have an awful lot to add to that. There's nothing factually incorrect in the program. It's just that it was all old news, which I found a little bit strange. And I'm not being critical of the actual content of the program. It was fine. there's nothing that they said that was incorrect as far as I could make out, but these are all stories that have been examined in quite close detail for quite a few years. And, you know, as I said in my tweet, that the City Football Group, which seemed to be the main focus of the program, that they've been in Australia now for 7 years. So I was trying to figure out really what the hook was. Now, some people have said to me, and look, this is fair enough, well, it doesn't matter if it's 7 years old. You know, if it's a story that, you know, should be focused upon, then now is as good a time as any. And look, I guess that's fair. But this, unfortunately, is modern sport, and it's the modern world. And, you know, as a Manchester City fan, you know, I've got my own reservations about, you know, certain things that the City Football Group do, and certainly, you know, the regime that they represent. But in modern life, you know, Australia deals with lots of regimes that some of us might find unpalatable in various aspects of life, be they politically, economically, on the sporting field, etc., etc. You know, football is no different. And yet it seemed to me that the program was sort of trying to portray this was something that we didn't know. Well, we've known it for years. That's not to say that it's all hunky-dory, but it's not new. And I wondered whether, you know, some new information that they might have might come to life, but not from what I saw. So it was, look, it's a strange one. And again, I'm not criticising the content of the program, because, as I say, everything that I heard was factually correct. It's just that we've heard it all before.
From a journalistic perspective, is it fair to conflate the City Football Club, you know, the identities, the owners, Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Khaldun Al Mubarak, and British Aussie Simon Pearce? Is it fair to conflate them with UAE government human rights violations and other UAE royal family alleged crimes? I mean, is it fair to do that?
Well, look, that's not for me to judge. You know, everybody will have their own opinions on that. Now, you know, is Melbourne City, for example, is it run by the Emiratis, ultimately Sheikh Mansour? Yes. But, I mean, we're not going to deny that. It would be stupid to. Khaldun Mubarak is technically the chairman of Melbourne City, but he's chairman of the City Football Group. So, you know, the allegation in this program is, you know, we shouldn't have these people in Australia, and I at least involved in, you know, in sports in Australia, and I sort of understand that, but by the same token, isn't the Melbourne Cup sponsored by, isn't it the Etihad or the Emirates Melbourne Cup? You know, how far do we go with this? If you want to scratch the surface of every business deal involved in sports, then you're going to uncover quite a lot of dirt and, you know, a lot of things that are probably unpalatable to a lot of people. I'm not, you know, defending any regime, nor am I necessarily defending their role in football. What I'm saying, and it's the same with the Bakeries and, you know, David Traktorvenko. I'm not quite sure how David Traktorvenko got dragged into it all, but anyway. You know, but they've all been there for years. If this had happened in 2014, I'd have said, yeah, fair enough. If this had happened post-separation, which I think was formalised 31st of December 2020, I'd have said, yeah, fair enough, it's a current topic. But it just seemed as though it had been sort of dragged out of nowhere, which is a bit baffling. But look, I'm not, you know, angry about it or upset about it. I went on Twitter because it was purely an observation that these are all stories that have been covered pretty much in depth by both the Australian football media, the Australian broader media, and with regard to the City Football Group, by overseas media ad infinitum. They're not new stories. And I guess like many football fans in this country, I watch thinking, well, you know, maybe they've got some new revelations. Maybe there's something new that's come to light, but it didn't happen. So I'm just a bit mystified by it. And I think a lot of football fans were, by the timing as much as anything else.
So, I mean, they let Martin Lee alone. They didn't talk about him. But also, they didn't cover Tinkler. They didn't cover Palmer. They didn't cover Tony Sage in Perth trying to sell his club to some, you know, backroom cryptocurrency mob. They didn't cover any of that. Mm. They didn't cover the A-League war with the Lowies. They didn't cover any of that. I mean, when they talk about the UAE, they didn't cover the fact that Etihad sponsored, you know, Dockland Stadium in Melbourne for 9 years. They didn't do any of that. So it just seems to me that it was very targeted at a few people. And I do personally feel a bit sorry for David Traktovenko, who's been a fabulous owner. And, you know, they tried to conflate that he's not a good person by the fact that he might know Vladimir Putin and once owned some shares in a bank along with a couple of other thousand people. So it's just, for me, it was disappointing that the game gets targeted in that way. But that's, I've had my say, you've had your say, and I'm sure Rob has similar thoughts.
Yeah, I do. Well, look, let's move along. The move to the 10 network, Simon, it seems to have been a good one. It's only just beginning. You know, the A-League is still a little while away. But tell us how you've settled in, what your perceptions are of the network's commitment to the sport. And, you know, are there any little tip-offs you can give us about what to expect from you know, the coverage over the next, you know, 12 months or so?
Well, no tip-offs. No, we're still very much in, obviously, the building phase and, you know, putting together of the teams. And it's like a football team, you know. You put 11 new guys together, they're going to take a while to gel. So, you know, that's all sort of in the mix at the moment. Am I enjoying it? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm loving being, you know, back involved in football on a day-to-day basis. Not that I ever really went away from that anyway. In fact, in some ways, I was, you know, busier when I was freelancing than I am at the moment. But that'll be changing in the next few weeks. It's what has really encouraged me is that, from what I've seen so far, Channel 10, Paramount Plus, everybody's very much on the same page. They're very keen, very enthusiastic, very excited by the possibility of, you know, taking hold of this sport and looking to grow it and getting it back to where we believe it belongs, and hopefully beyond that as well over the next 5 years. There's an awful lot of work to do. There won't be a silver bullet. We know that. You know, we've dropped a long way, unfortunately, in the last few years. So we've got to rebuild people's trust in the product as much as anything else, and get them back on side with the teams and the clubs that they support. But I'm excited. It's a big challenge. It feels fresh. It feels new. There'll be some innovation, I have no doubt. I think a lot of the stuff that will come out over the next few weeks will excite people. They'll be looking to the next generation as much as, you know, keeping the traditional football fan on board, which I think is a great mix. And, yeah, it's up to us all to deliver on this. And it starts in a few weeks' time. I can't wait.
Simon, you're back covering the Matildas and the Socceroos as part of your role at 10 and Paramount Plus. Just give us your thoughts on the Socceroos continuing to play qualification games away from home, and just how much the match against Oman being played in Qatar it potentially is a sticky one for us, because Oman's in good form. It would be much better to play them in Sydney, we know, but how significant is it for us not to play that game at home and having to play in the Middle East?
Look, to be fair, I think that so far they've dealt with life on the road pretty well. I mean, not only the first phase of qualification, but, you know, the game against China could have been a banana skin, potentially, and they dealt with that quite easily. They went to Vietnam, which was a much more difficult game, much more difficult. And to be honest, the conditions they will have in Qatar at the Khalifa International Stadium will be a whole lot better than they were in Hanoi. So I don't hold too many fears that's not to say that I'm disrespecting Oman, because they are a side on the improve. There's no doubt about that. They went to Japan and won, which is no easy thing to do. So they're going to be a tough nut to crack. But I still think man for man, Australia are the better team. And I think if they can get the 3 points in that game, then that gives them just that little bit of a buffer, a bit of breathing space. Because, of course, 5 days later, they then go to Japan, which, let's be honest, that's the toughest. I know Japan lost to Oman at home, but Japan away is the toughest game in the group. So, you know, that's going to be difficult to go there and get 3 points. So they need to beat Oman. Would it be better in Sydney or somewhere else in Australia? Yeah, of course it would. But we know that at the moment, because of the pandemic and the lockdowns, that's just not feasible. So we've got to deal with it and, you know, get on with it. Probably the people I feel most sorry for are the players, and particularly Graham Arnold and Ryan Grant, who've, you know, been away. I think Graham Arnold's been away from home for about 4 or 5 months because of the Olympics and qualifiers before that and the qualifiers after it. So, you know, yeah, I don't think he's set foot on Australian soil in 5 months. Tony Gustafsson, the Matildas coach, still hasn't been to Australia. He's been in charge for the best part of a year. So, you know, the sooner we get out of these lockdowns and start easing conditions, obviously the better, not just for our coaches, but for our players. But in the interim, look, I have no doubts that the Socceroos will deal with whatever is thrown before them. They've done it before 100 times and they'll do it again.
We hope you're right, Simon. We desperately hope you're right. And what an irony it is that that Arnie can't get into his house and in Melbourne we can't get out of ours, mate. So anyway...
we're the same in Sydney, Simon, if it's any consolation.
Yeah, exactly. Simon Hill, thank you, mate. We're loving the work that you're doing and so glad that the voice of football in this country has landed where he needs to be, talking about the game. Mate, we'll talk to you again real soon, probably just on the brink of the season's commencing.
Thanks very much, guys, and thanks for all your support over the last 12 months. It's much appreciated.
No, always, mate, in your corner. Okay, stick around after the break. Andy Naylor from The Athletic. We're going to talk Brighton and Hove Albion. What's going on down there? At one point, they could have been top if they had beaten Crystal Palace on the weekend, and they very nearly managed to do that. Andy Naylor from The Athletic next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King.
The kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial
goal. Yes, this is Box to Box. And we do love an underdog story on this show. We did start back in 2015 when the Foxes went on their incredible run. We found a man who is now become our good friend Rob Tanner, who was then at the Leicester Mercury, now at the Athletic, and he has managed to introduce us to a lot of wonderful journos in the UK over the years. And our very next guest is one of those from the Athletic. He has the Brighton and Hove Albion beat. Andy Naylor, welcome to the show.
Good to be on.
Andy, just a great story. I mean, verge of relegation 1 minute. The only thing that could have made it better was if Matt Ryan was still in goals and Aaron Moy was strutting his stuff. But but from an Aussie point of view, of course. But we're loving seeing what the Seagulls are doing.
Yeah, well, it is a great story so far this season. Let's put it into a bit of perspective. It's still early days. But, you know, we're talking about a club that in their 4 seasons in the Premier League have finished in the bottom 6 each time. Here they are, 6 games in the top 6, flying. So, a lot of encouraging signs.
I've been interested to look at last season and this season, and they seem to be converting more goals. What's changed between last season and this season? Because the squad is largely the same, but they just seem to have hit a purple patch. What do you put it down to?
Well, it's interesting you say that, and you mentioned sort of taking chances. Anyone who's watched Brighton regularly, particularly in Graham Potter's reign, will know that this is not some sort of magical formula they've suddenly come up with that has transformed them. There's been an underlying pattern to the way they've been playing. And they were playing well last season. They performed well in an awful lot of games last season. There were just little moments, decisions going against them, and they didn't take their chances. The 1-1 draw at Crystal Palace was a classic example. Neil Mopay had been marked out of the game, got one chance, took it superbly late on. That point came a year and a day after they pulverised Manchester United at the Amex. Don't know if you remember that game. They hit the woodwork 5 times, Brighton, and then lost to a 100th minute penalty. And that wasn't the only game last season where things like similar things happened to them. So I think it's a combination of taking those chances when they come, and also those little moments, the bits of rubber, the green, are actually working in their favour at the moment.
Now, a player that I thought that they would miss dearly is Ben White. However, Shane Duffy, who was up at Celtic, has returned to the club, and he's just fitted in beautifully and creating a lot of havoc at set pieces as well. Tell us about Shane Duffy, and is he the answer to the hole that Ben left?
Well, again, it's an almost a bit of a fairy tale story, the rejuvenation of Shane, because he went on loan to Celtic. It didn't look like he really had a future at Brighton. Celtic was his boyhood club. That looked a great move for him. It didn't work out. It came soon after the death of his father. He struggled in Scotland, had a bad time there, actually came back early towards the end of last season. Of course, Ben White was sold to Arsenal in the summer, but you're still thinking then, Brighton have got a lot of central defenders, and you're still thinking Shane probably hasn't got a future at the club. But he's come back in and just been the Shane Duffy of old, really. He's a great character to have in the dressing room. Everyone at the club loves him, and he's a really good... Well, I don't like to use the word old-fashioned because that's being unkind to him. It's not like he's bad on the ball, but Shane's main strength is the way he defends the box. And also, of course, as you've highlighted, defends the box aerially, and he's also a real threat at the other end when it comes to set pieces. So he's been a real bonus, if you like, since the sale of Ben White. And they've actually absorbed Ben White's sale. You know, they haven't brought anyone else in. And yet here we are. They've still got a very good defensive record so far.
Andy, let's talk about the manager. It's you know, it's obvious that Graham Potter has made an enormous difference and had a massive impact on the club. But for those that maybe don't follow Brighton Hove Albion as closely as you do, what has Graham Potter done? And you know, it's not just on the pitch with his tactics and his game management, but just around the club generally.
It shouldn't be underestimated how difficult it is in the Premier League to come in and do what he's done. He took over from Chris Hughton, who did a fantastic job, got them up, kept them up for two seasons. Chris's style was kind of based on the team being well organised and resilient. Graham's got a contrasting style, sort of building up from the back through the thirds, largely possession-based football, you'd say. So he was changing the style while trying to keep Brighton progressing. Like I said, that is not an easy thing to do. He's managed to do that. The age of the squad has come down dramatically. Their kind of recruitment policy is to look at value, mainly from overseas, and not exclusively, but mainly. We're talking about young players who they feel can develop through Graham's coaching and improve, hopefully to play on the first team. Alternatively, they've got a high resale value. And they've also got the academy now. We're seeing the shoots of the academy that was established sort of a decade ago, really come into the fore now with young players coming through each season. The two in the squad now, Hayden Roberts, a promising young central defender, and Taylor Richards, midfielder. They had loan spells last season in lower divisions, Rochdale and Doncaster respectively, and now they're in the squad on regular members on the bench. So he's really, really pushed the club on from where they were. You couldn't see Brighton previously being more than a bottom six club. You can now.
And of course they're going to take on Arsenal this weekend, where Ben White of course has gone and will likely line up. Arsenal obviously have recovered from their disastrous start to the season and heading up the table towards Brighton. But how will Brighton take on this game? Do you feel like there's a realisation here that they've come out of their shell as a club, as you said, that was a sort of a cellar dweller, and actually this Arsenal team, although, you know, big reputation and big club, but maybe there's nothing to fear here and they should go for it?
Well, absolutely. I don't think Brighton go into no game is easy for Brighton in the Premier League. They're still at that stage where you can't call any game an easy game. But by the same token, there's no game where they're not capable of getting a result in. We've seen that already under Graham. I mean, their first significant away win under him was at Arsenal. They'd previously beaten Spurs at home. They've drawn with Chelsea. They've beaten Manchester United. They've drawn at Liverpool. They beat Man City. City were down to 10 men fairly early on, back in the last season. So you always feel they've got a chance in games. One slight concern is, injuries-wise, they haven't really been done any favours. I think it would be really important if Yves Bissouma is fit to face Arsenal. He missed out against Crystal Palace with a left knee injury. That was compounded because Stephen Alzate, who came on in midfield for the second half, he got an injury, so the sub had to be subbed. They're still without Adam Webster at the back, one of their key central defenders. So I think Basuma's influence particularly will be important in their prospects of getting a result.
Andy, you're talking to an Australian audience, obviously, and recently Matt Ryan made some comments about his departure from Brighton in that it was a shock to him. A lot of Australian fans didn't think he was doing anything really that wrong and was playing well. He formed a great affinity with the fans. Can you tell us from, you know, someone who's, you know, watching everything so closely, you know, what do you think that decision came down to? Was he playing badly? Because I think Australian fans were pretty much right behind his performances at Brighton.
Yeah. No, by no stretch of the imagination was Matt necessarily playing badly. I kind of align this to the way the club moved on in terms of their decision to replace Chris Hughton with Graham Potter. And Graham took, let's face it, a pretty brave decision. Matty was well established as Brighton's number one. And Robert Sanchez, young goalkeeper who'd been out on loan, gave him his chance from the December. And he's really grasped it. And we've seen why, I think, in matches since then, why Graham took that decision. Matty has lots of strengths and lots of abilities as a goalkeeper. He's not that big, so sort of dominating from set plays for the opposition and stuff would not necessarily be one of his biggest strengths. Rob he's 6'4" and he has a real kind of air of calm and confidence about him when the ball's come in the air, and that gives the confidence to the defenders around him as well. And the other thing is, and again, I'm not saying that Matty's distribution is bad, but Robert Sanchez with the ball at his feet is exceptional. We saw two examples of that at Crystal Palace, one in the first half where he pinged a long ball for Danny Welbeck to run onto. And there was another one in the second half where as soon as Jakub Moda, their Polish international midfielder, came on, he pinged another. It wasn't just a punt, it was a long pass upfield which just totally turned defence into attack. He's a really impressive young goalkeeper. Don't forget he's already got in the Spain squad. So I don't think that's a reflection on Matt that he was any way performing particularly badly. It's just that he's been replaced by an exceptional young goalkeeper who I've got no doubt at all will go on to be Spain's number one.
Andy, thanks for jumping on the show. We really appreciate it, mate. We'll get you back on again in a month or so's time to just see how the story's tracking.
Only too happy to speak to you again.
Excellent. Andy Naylor from The Athletic. Great story there, Brighton and Hove Albion, just 1 point off top. All right, stick around after the break. We are going to wrap it all up. Derek's got a whole bunch of other stories in stoppage time next on Box to Box.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse,
home of real brands and real savings.
And Storage King,
the kings of storage, moving and more.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Yes, this is Box to Box. Been a fun show so far. Danny Townsend off the top talking the Australian Professional Leagues. Our friend Simon Hill, waxing lyrical on the Four Corners story. Andy Naylor from Brighton and Hove Albion before the break. But stoppage time, the new and improved extended stoppage time. We're going to talk with Derek in a moment. But before we do, our very good friends at Storage King are wonderful corporate citizens in every sense of the word. I can tell you for sure they've been supporting my endeavours with the Cerebral Palsy Alliance in September. My little Alexander, who everyone who listens to this show knows has cerebral palsy, he's their ambassador during the month of September, and he is absolutely loving his role motivating the kings and queens of storage down at Storage King. I tell you what they also do is support breast cancer. Now, during the month of October, if you buy a pink tea chest or carry box sold from Storage King, Storage King will donate $1 to the McGrath Foundation. How good is that? Contactless moving down to Storage King. They'll keep you as safe as the things you store. So get into Storage King. Go to storageking.com.au for your nearest store. They are the kings of corporate good citizenship, storage, moving, and more. Our good friends, Storage King. Derek, we've got a bit to talk about to bring this show home. Derby County just goes from bad to worse. Our old mate Dean Hennessy, who has been a part of this program for so many years, just gutted. But look, at least they had a glimmer of good news with a win.
They did. They're actually now back into positive points. They were on -2 before this game, but they beat Reading 1-0. And look, by all accounts, Reading, one of a clutch of Championship clubs and EFL clubs who are on the brink at the moment financially. Derby County are with the administrators at the moment. That means that the administrators, what that will mean for them is that they're trying to keep the club afloat. They're trying to pay as many bills as they can. They'll be trying to play the players and the staff primarily as well. And their job is to try and find an owner for Derby County. There has been some haircutting going on. Steve McLaren was there in a kind of a consultation role. He's gone, but Wayne Rooney in his massive £2.5 million per year wages are still there, albeit apparently Wayne has taken a pay cut this year in order to allow certain members of the squad to be paid. We know at the start of the season they didn't actually have a full squad. They were lucky to field an 11 during pre-season, and this is all because Mel Morris, a man himself who took over the club and has pumped a lot of money into it, he has apparently lost £200 million in Derby County. But what's essentially happened is that they took a punt on getting to the Premier League. You'll recall a couple of years ago under Frank Lampard, they came agonisingly close to the Premier League and the hundreds of millions of dollars pounds and dollars that generates. So they threw the kitchen sink at it and it didn't work. And now they're in a situation where, you know, they're struggling to pay the players. They've made several redundancies. The administrators have said that there has been some interest. Of course, Derby doesn't own its stadium, doesn't own its training ground, but what it does have is that Championship place, that seat at the table, and that potential for an investor to take them over, pay off the 40 or 50 million of the debts, and then try and have a crack at Premier League glory. But Edge, you know, after Burnley going, clubs like Reading on the brink, Oldham failing to pay their players and looking like they're sliding out of the Football League, this is just another story, a sad story of, you know, an owner just rolling the dice and taking a gamble and not paying off.
Well, the old adage is if you want to be a millionaire, start by being a billionaire and buy a Championship football club and you quickly become a millionaire again. Mel Morris, £200 million, as you mentioned, Derek. That is an oh golly gosh moment for sure. What's been interesting, and hasn't sort of come out in the media just yet, Derek, is that the American private equity firm MSD, which owed £20 million, they are in the driver's seat with the administrator. Mel Morris and MSD need to reach an agreement on who is going to fund the club going forward until they can cobble together a business sale. That that's what Morris is looking for. He's looking to sell the club. But given the debt, the pandemic, the graveyard that's been the Championship, you know, there's so much debt generally in the Championship at the moment. I think they're going to, I think they're they've got a very, very deep hole to climb out of. And of their £60 million debt, £30 million to the tax office, they won't be able to avoid that. £20 million to the equity firm, they won't be able to avoid that. And £10 million to football creditors, effectively players, and they can't avoid that as well. So whoever buys them, they've got to come up with 60 and the ongoing cost and probably more to invest and get some players in the transfer window to try and stay in the Championship and reboot for next year. It's a big hole, Derek.
And if you're a Wickham fan or an owner or a player, you'd be pretty annoyed at the moment, I think, chaps, because Wickham, of course, went down at the expense of Derby County in that squeaky bum of a final day of the Championship season last year. Derby just about kept themselves afloat, didn't go into administration, or they could, you know, and then chose to do it this season instead. I believe already that Wickham are extremely annoyed about this and are considering their options too. Derby are 1 point at the moment. You know, they would actually be in mid-table right now if they didn't have that points deduction. But I read somewhere that they thought Derby were gone. They're not gone. They're only, you know, 6 or 7 points from climbing out of the relegation places, and they're winning games. I mean, it's, to be honest, Rooney and the support team around him are doing a remarkable job, Rob. And, you know, we'll keep an eye on Derby County because of the connection to Dino, an illustrious club. And look, it will just be fascinating to see, as Ed said, who's going to put the money down, because that one of 24 Championship seats, that is still one of the biggest tickets in football, and it's worth a lot of money.
Yeah, it sure is. Well, they've got Swansea this weekend, and 4 points there would be gold. Swansea only a couple of spots on the ladder above them. So, look, it's just well and truly within their grasp to keep that spot at the table. So, you know, every fan of every other club in relegation battles, you know, has got limited sympathy for clubs like Derby, who, you know, have problems of their own making. But you know, when you've got a club of that stature, you know, you just don't want to see them just slipping down the football firmament the way that clubs like Sunderland have done over the journey. Okay, well, another big issue during the week was the safe standing topic. You know, we all grew up, you know, blokes in their 40s and 50s standing at games. It's part of the fun of attending live football matches, and it seemed to have gone the way of the dodo. But maybe the reports of its demise were a little exaggerated, Del.
Yeah, this topic's been bubbling along for some time. I know the great Kevin Miles, the head of the Fan Association back in the UK, says that this has been two or three full games and replays, extra time and penalties to get this over the line. But clubs in the first two flights of English football, where currently all seat stadia is mandatory, can now apply to introduce areas where fans can stand. You know, we all know Manchester United and some of the other clubs have already installed that safe standing area in anticipation of being able to allow fans back into their stadiums with railed seating. The other clubs, Chelsea, Liverpool, Manchester City, Tottenham, Wolves, have all applied. And look, we were talking on this show last week about Manchester City's inability to fill their stadium during a, you know, what looked like quite a tasty midweek Champions League tie against Leipzig, and this is probably one of the initiatives that could turn that around. I presume it will be affordable. I presume that there will be a novelty value to it. We all know that the standing was taken away because of, you know, what happened at Hillsborough all those years ago and the tragic scenes there. But I think the consensus is that safe standing will bring back some of the atmosphere back into the English stadiums. I've only stood on safe standing once at the old Brentford ground, and yeah, it was quite fun. But Edge, you have stood safely at football grounds, I'm sure, not just here in Australia, but potentially around the world. Do you see this as a good idea?
Oh, I really do. I think standing at the football is a great experience. It won't be like the old days where they used to pack them in, and there will be a standing spot, you know, an allocation like a seat. But railed seating is really interesting. Manchester United, Manchester City, Crystal Palace, Liverpool, Leeds, Tottenham and Wolverhampton all have railed seating in some areas of their stadium now, and that they see that as the path to safe standing is the railed seating, and then eventually the seats are taken away. What's really interesting, when I was in Buenos Aires last year and I saw Boca Juniors play, the railed seating, which is like a standing environment, was right around the stadium, and it does make for fabulous atmosphere, because you can stand, you can be animated, you can move around a little bit, you can see your mates two rows down, all that sort of stuff, and I think it's the way to go. And obviously we've got it here in Australia with the CommBank Stadium in Western Sydney, and Western Sydney Wanderers have safe standing as well. So for me, it's one of the unique aspects of seeing football, and I think it's fabulous it's making a return in England, because we know the Hillsborough disaster was the reason that all these stadiums went to fully seated, but with good regulation and the railed seating and the safe standing, it's going to make a comeback, and football will be the better for it.
I tell you, somewhere that didn't struggle for atmosphere at the weekend, we have to talk about it. We've had a pretty dire season, Edge, but the atmosphere was absolutely scintillating at the Emirates Stadium for Arsenal's 3-1 romp over Spurs, and all power to them, and I'm sure the American owners at Arsenal will be very excited. And that is the segue for the final little topic, Edge, which is American ownership in Serie A. What's going on there?
Well, I just thought it was really interesting that seven clubs are owned by North American interests, and of those seven clubs, other than AC Milan, which is currently owned by a hedge fund after the collapse of the Chinese owners, but all of the other clubs, Roma, AC Milan, Fiorentina, Parma, Spezia, Bologna and Venezia, are all owned by Americans with Italian heritage. And it just proves that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, Rob. Even though they're American owners and they've made their lives and fortunes in America, they're buying clubs, and they're buying clubs in Italy for the very good reason that they are cheap. The situation is that they're getting them for about a third of the price that you could buy a Premier League or a Bundesliga club, and I think it's good business. I'm really looking forward to the comeback of Italian football. I actually think that they can overtake La Liga in time, and I think the culture and the tapestry of Italian football is rich, but I'm just interested in Rob's view of what he thinks of these Italian-American millionaire and billionaires buying up the clubs that have been traditionally owned by families for hundreds of years or 100 years.
Well, look, this is a topic that deserves more conversation. That's one part of my answer. The other part of the answer is that if they're in such dire straits that they're going to go to the wall, then I would rather them be bought by people who have a passion for their Italian heritage than anybody else. As everyone knows, I'm married to a girl whose parents came here in the 60s. She couldn't speak English when she went to school. My older son in particular, he really throws towards his Italian heritage. We were down there at Lygon Street during the Euros. The Italians are passionate about their heritage, whether they live in Italy or whether they live anywhere else. So, yeah, I don't think it's a bad thing given, you know, the scenario that some of these clubs are faced with. So, look, let's park that one for a conversation another day. Gentlemen, we have run out of time. This is the stop to stoppage time. Edge, great show. It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and I agree with Derek. It was fun last weekend. Go the Gunners.
We got it. We get the rundown,
we,
I said.
We get over Brighton this week, and Uncle Rob will be shaking in his pants. We're on the way back. We're on the way back.
Yeah, right. Derek, thank you.
Yep, come on, you Gunners.
And Willem, I think you're sort of lurking in the background there somewhere. I'm not sure that you're on mic, but great job. And Damo, he is not on the mic, but has pieced this whole thing together. Thank you. And thank you for listening to us again, Box to Box. We have a lot of fun doing this show, and we're glad you're enjoying it. Please tell your friends, like it on your favourite podcast catcher, and spread the word.
Share it, Rob. Share it with your mates.
Exactly, exactly. And join us next week when we go from one end of the pitch to the other in the World Game.